Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between you, your community, your neighborhood, your region, our society, and everything that's going on in our global world, and our health, food, environment, public policy, and the popular attitudes and inducements from major media to believe and buy in and follow a establishment consensus versus making the kinds of changes in our society and in our world that are going to be bringing justice to people and stability to whatever degree possible to our climate and the earth. And so we're addressing the big picture systemic issues and how they connect to us through conversations with different thought leaders, experts, scientists, advocates, authors, economists, filmmakers, and all doctors, all kinds of different people that each have a different facet of what connects the dots from ourselves to the big picture. I'm a longstanding journalist in these areas covering these topics in a range of publications. And on today's show, I'm really thrilled to have a guest that I've been looking forward to speaking with for quite some time because our guest today, Andres Bernal, really has a missing link to some very important understandings that are part of our kind of holistic picture of how we can really move together in a constructive way in a time of looming crisis and high risk. And so there's a very important facet of all of this that he talks about and is knowledgeable about. And so I'm really happy that we'll be talking today here on Connect the Dots and that you listeners will have the benefit of his wisdom. Andres is the Director of Outreach at the Modern Money Network. We're going to be talking about economics today. He's also a research fellow at the Global Institute for Sustainable Prosperity, as well as a doctoral student and adjunct professor on policy, and he also manages something called the New Society Institute. So he's really a next-generation thought leader, policy leader, connector and networker, as well as advisor to leading elected officials, and we'll talk a little bit more about that on the show. One of the things that's really interesting is that from the perspective that we have here on Connect the Dots, we've really been talking about all of the environmental, health, and food systems that have gone awry and really have a damaging impact here on planet Earth. And, you know, we've also been talking about the solutions in terms of getting the right progressive leadership elected and in office and really facing the need to organize and do that aggressively to protect all life on Earth, quite truthfully. So Andres is a next-generation thought leader, an economist, and some of this problems and the stuckness has come out of some of the consensus built in the older generations, and I think we see where the next generations are really generating so much creativity, energy, enthusiasm, and movement building to kind of save our collective derrieres. So on that note, I'm really delighted to welcome to Connect the Dots, Andres Bernal.
Hi, Allison. Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here. And thank you for such a lovely introduction.
Oh, well, it's great to have you here. And I know you're really busy with a whole bunch of interesting initiatives. But I think the timing is really important to revisit some of the areas of discussion that were so central to everybody's focus concerning the Green New Deal back in the winter of 2019 when the proposal was launched by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, whom I know you have advised and served as an advisor to, and no doubt played a backstage role in shaping that terrific policy initiative, which is developing, movement building, and, you know, getting poised to move forward. But a lot depends on our understanding of it, how it can happen, and why we really need to mobilize behind the leadership, political leadership opportunities that we have, and not get sort of confused by an array of constructed and false options. So, let's just talk about that. We've just had a situation where the Democratic National Committee has basically slammed the door on even having a climate discussion at the upcoming Democratic Party debates among the potential nominees, which is occurring, you know, in another, week or so, in two nights. We're going to be listening to 26 candidates, but that topic is left out. And yet, for many of us, it's a number one topic. First of all, do you have any thoughts on that? What's going on here with they're actually sweeping climate off the table at the time when it really is our number one issue.
Well, I mean, I think that's a terribly short-sighted mistake by the party. You know, the rationale for it was really that they didn't want to have one debate on a single issue, but you know, I think that really just demonstrates that they're missing the big picture here and the seriousness and the urgency of what the climate crisis and the environmental crisis is all about. And again, I think that's just a consequence of how much our politics has been co-opted by, you know, all of these moneyed special interests and a kind of thinking about the world that's very much detached from, political issues that that are much bigger picture than just like, how am I going to get reelected? How are we going to raise money for the party? How are, you know, things like that, kind of bureaucratic administrative things, issues that have to do with making sure that our ties with the funders are coming in. That's what politics has become. And so it's not surprising that they miss such a big picture and serious thing, but it's also very incredibly scary that they're not taking this as seriously as they should be.
Yes, and we even, have the, polls reveal that he may not even still be the front runner, it's now looking in the polls that, in a score of recent polls, that Bernie Sanders has the highest margins and the greatest certainty of actually defeating Trump. And of course, climate is one of his issues. And at the same time, we have Biden, Joe Biden, who nominally, according to the Democrats, is a key voice, basically going out to fundraise on Wall Street just yesterday and telling people on the Wall Streeters and who, financially support these types of candidates, telling them that nothing would fundamentally change, no one's standard of living would change and nothing would fundamentally change. That's his promise to the people who are going to be funding him and putting out advertising. In contrast, we have two candidates in Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren who, are not taking corporate money, and Bernie in particular has a very wide, already established network of people donors that is sustaining and fortifying and his campaign. So, it's kind of like this nomination is really the moratorium on, it's a referendum on climate. So let's step back and revisit, where things stand. Like, how will the nomination impact our ability to undertake a Green New Deal in the next administration? I mean, it's pretty obvious.
Well, I think it's absolutely critical because the approach to how policy is going to be constructed and what kinds of policies and government responses are going to be enacted basically shapes the boundaries of the degree to which we can respond to this climate crisis. So if we're going to continue down the approach of, maybe taxing carbon a little bit here and there, or waiting for renewable energy to kind of emerge as less costly through the market, or enacting cap and trade programs and kind of going through this very measured approach, that's just going to lead to a disaster. I mean, there are already calculations that if we can't keep climate from rising below 2 degrees Celsius by mid-century, we're going to be seeing, you know, millions of refugees around the world. And as we already know now, displacements of people who have to leave where they live because of the political, the economic, or the climate conditions is also contributing to this rise in xenophobia and far right-wing politics and all of this kind of like an approach to society based on notions of purity, of the, you know, being a pure American, or, you know, kind of these very scary returns to what really is fascist ideologies. And so that's a very scary thing. Some people kind of speak to the prospect of ecological fascism as things get worse and worse with this climate situation. So if we can't build a politics and an approach to policy that is grounded in solidarity, that is grounded in kind of a new establishment of core rights for people to be a part of this society, and a sense of international cooperation, solidarity, and mutual respect for, you know, just the human condition, we're going to go down a pretty dark path pretty quickly. And that's why I think it's so important that we nominate the right person, and that we continue to put pressure not just on this presidential election, but just on any kind of form of institutional life that that kind of really celebrates human life, and that can shift away from what we've had for so many decades now. So that's absolutely critical. And you know, we're just going to have to keep on pushing.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I was also in the wake of Trump's, you know, launching his own presidential campaign and doing so, you know, on the back of immigrants and migrants and, you know, kind of upscaling those attacks. And in the last week, we've had Representative Ocasio-Cortez saying, really characterizing the so-called detention centers in which immigrants are held by this administration as concentration camps. And then there's been a kind of debate, are they or aren't they, and, you know, oh, no, don't, you know, go so far as to say that, you know, kind of thing. But, you know, what we know historically is that, you know, none of what came to pass in Germany or in other, you know, fascist societies, you know, began on day one with the end point. And so, you know, this reluctance to, you know, the courage of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to name it, and on the other side, the reluctance, oh, no, let's not put that label on it. Oh, dear, then maybe, you know, we look worse than we want to think we look. But, you know, what we know is that there's a progression, and, you know, inhumane housing of people, treating them on a subhuman level, and then, you know, with a large swath of the population psychically distancing themselves from that and thinking that it could never happen to them is exactly the trajectory of all fascistic societies. And, you know, sad to say, but that's really the case. And with climate adding to the picture, I don't think anyone can sit securely, anybody in any whatever economic status that or location where we might fantasize that we are protected, I don't actually believe that anyone can really know whether, in fact, it's only going to be people of a lower economic status, you know, or different ethnicities, not one's own, who, you know, are uprooted and whose lives are completely overturned by this. The fact that we kind of normalize that and then believe that it couldn't for some reason come to people in all different locations, I mean, it can and it will. So we actually have had almost like a historic test to say, will we take a stand, you know, when they, you know, they come and take the journalists or, you know, whomever are the first of the people, or, you know, the poorer people or the immigrants, will we take a stand? And, you know, And then, you know, if you don't take a stand, then they come for you. Well, the truth is that the climate will come for everybody, you know. And so we'll all be in this position, and we should therefore really have empathy, identify, and you know, sort of draw the line here, you know, rather than, sleeping through this and normalizing that it's happening to somebody else. And that makes it even more crucial what happens in terms of the 2020 election. Let's take a historic or a little bit of a back step, because when the Green New Deal was kind of front and center in the public dialogue this last winter, 2019, you know, one of the perceived obstacles that the Republicans and even mainstream Democrats were throwing in the path of developing and passing this was how, you know, can we pay for it? Can we afford it? How could we possibly do this? It's going to be too costly. People didn't want their taxes to being raised. And one of the things that's occurred, and you're very much at the center of this, is that there's a new economic paradigm for, what's called the macro economy, you know, the big national systemic economy. And some, you know, there's been a new kind of shift in paradigm that is underway. And so to understand whether we can pay for it and how we could pay for it, I think people need to kind of get a little crash course in that changing paradigm. Could you give our listeners a bit of an orientation?
Yes, absolutely. I actually want to kind of quickly respond to the what
sure.
you were mentioning about the concentration camps and the horrible things that we're doing at our southern border, and actually how that
yes.
connects to this conversation about the Green New Deal and about, the controversy around how we're going to pay for these things. I've been following this and tweeting about it and whatnot, because it's very rare that governments announce that they're going to create concentration camps. You know, they don't just kind of say like, yeah, that's what we're doing. They don't admit to it. Right. So part of what I think of governments that are becoming fascist or authoritarian rely on is this kind of delusion amongst people that they are being patriotic and righteous and doing the right thing or responding to criminal activity or responding to some kind of nuisance or threat that has entered in their society in kind of in-group versus out-group way. And that's exactly what we're seeing now. So what Alexandria did with her comments and with affirming that we are using concentration camps, which, you know, all historians all across the country are agreeing with her on this. What she's doing is exposing kind of this false sense of niceness and morality that so many people in our culture kind of show the public through their image, that this kind of stance of we are righteous Americans and we would never do something like that, and we have to do this because how else are we going to handle all this immigration and whatnot, right? So these comments really expose the underlying social pathology behind these actions, right? And so I think one of the things that is contributing to kind of luring people into this kind of ideology and thinking, you know, which is very proto-fascist, if not already fascist itself, mm-hmm. is, I do think it's a disease. It's a social collective disease to act like this, to see the world in this way, to dehumanize people in this way. And so one of the things that kind of contributes to luring people in this direction, to luring people towards white supremacy, to luring people towards xenophobia, is kind of a scarcity mentality. That their lives are already under pressure. They may see that their standard of living is perhaps not what they want it to be, that the American dream that they were sold is not turning out the way they thought it would. All of these kinds of, maybe people in their family or around them have some kind of substance abuse problem. We are already seeing this opioid addiction. It could be a number of things, right? And they believe kind of like, well, we're out of money. We are, there's nothing left to do to spend on. So this idea that we're going to spend all of this money on a Green New Deal or whatnot, or maybe Medicare for all, in their minds and through the manipulation, the propaganda of those in power, they kind of see that as going towards other people or just taking it from them, and redistributing all kinds of kind of false notions of the way the economy works that is very much grounded in a large part of the American identity and has been shaped by an orthodoxy, an orthodox approach to economics that has dominated for the last 3, 4, 5 decades. You know, oftentimes we call this neoliberalism, and this approach to economics itself is oftentimes referred to as neoclassical economics, and it has really infiltrated the imagination of people on a common sense level. And, you know, it's become an intuitive kind of thing where people see the world without having to study economics. Or oftentimes you'll hear people say, like, well, God, Bernie Sanders, right? He never took an economics 101 class, right? So that's kind of like the degree to which people have been shaped without even their knowledge by the orthodoxy of economics, even on the left sometimes.
Yes.
The standards for how we debate this thing and the, all of these issues, even when we consider ourselves as part of the resistance, the very standards are usually on conservative or right-wing terms because of this view or this paradigm of economics. And so it has a lot to do with what an economy is and what markets are and what money is. So for these purposes, we're talking about what money is, where it comes from, and how it can be used for different kind of initiatives or agendas, right? So in the kind of the mainstream orthodox story, if the government wants to do anything, it needs to find the money from somewhere. So it can tax people to get that money, or it can, quote-unquote, borrow from savers through deficit spending, through the debt, right? And so people see this and they say, oh, this is unsustainable. We keep spending and our debt is growing, and that's going to impoverish future generations for the next 50 years or something like that. And they see this number that's the national debt, and it's supposed to be this scary, scary thing, right? And this kind of goes from this notion that the economy is this natural thing, it just exists in nature, and markets have always been at the center of all human activity, meaning that human activity is organized by these rational beings who are always trying to trade with one another based on self-interested agendas and preferences. And then the government or some kind of authority can come in, it can intrude into that and maybe regulate it a little bit, or it could step out and just leave it be, right? And that's where a lot of this free market ideology comes from. And so all of that, if you study any history or anthropology or sociology, is not how it works. It's not how it's ever worked, right? There have been markets throughout the history of humanity, and there has been money throughout the history of humanity, but it has never been at the forefront. It has never dominated our social relations in the way that it does today. And I think more so, it's never been this natural phenomenon that has existed outside and independent of different authorities and different kind of legal structures or rules or normative structures that shape it. So today when we talk about markets...
So let me just interject something, Andrzej. So what you're saying is that we think that this is a natural or a God-given thing, that is not a human construction that favors one thing, compresses one thing, expands another, that has social values embedded in it, that has priorities embedded in it. We just have come to regard it in an incredibly naive way, as just kind of an eternal force that exists, and that, you know, we bow down to, or you know, and there isn't a lot of room for tweaking, rather than kind of admitting that, like the media, which we, you know, oh my God, they must be telling us the truth because they are well lit, well made up, and you know, they're coming to us from a brand name that we've heard of, you know, or whatever. I mean, I lecture people on this show and everywhere about the media all the time, since that's the field I've been in. But, you know, we just take for granted that this is, you know, this hasn't been shaped by human hands, and it isn't manipulated and constructed by human hands, and therefore it isn't in human hands to reshape it. Okay.
Well, and, exactly. And you know, the interesting thing about that is if you go back and look at the history of economic thought, many economists that you would set the foundations of what we consider the mainstream today, they were trying to copy physicists. They were trying to, you know, a lot of people joke around about physics envy. They were trying to construct theories based on even outdated notions of physics that we no longer use to describe the way that human beings interact with one another in an economy, right? So a lot of like these notions of equilibriums and free markets and whatnot come from like this like outdated 19th century notion of physics. So, you know, it exactly as you're saying, it kind of takes for granted the reality that markets and economies have always been shaped and are always grounded in and embedded in norms, power, legal structures, all these kinds of things, right? And so when we're coming to the notion of, like, how are we going to pay for these things, then you have to think about money. And in this kind of orthodox story, money is something that emerges naturally as well from all of this alleged trade and whatnot to be able to facilitate the process. And the government kind of comes in and can regulate it a bit, but it has to be very careful, right? Because, you know, it can disrupt the money supply that's supposed to be there naturally. It can disrupt natural interest rates or whatnot, right? So it has to be very, very careful and, you know, usually use some kind of a commodity to make sure that money is controlled, like gold or something like that. And kind of act to manage this process from kind of that laissez-faire perspective. And like we mentioned before, the only way that it can spend is if it takes money away from other people through taxes or bars and something like that. So in this new paradigm, in this new story, as we mentioned, one, we recognize that all of these economic institutions are socially constructed, politically constructed, legally constructed, and money is too. Money is also something like that. In fact, it's a legal political tool or artifact that has always been used, historically speaking, to organize society. Money comes actually from state or state-like structures that decided they needed some form of provisioning itself. Governments and states, or what preceded them, needed to provision themselves in some way and needed to ensure that people were paying debts to one another in certain kinds of ways. So we see kind of the invention of this thing called money, which is basically a debt. It's a form, but not the debt. We'll get to that a little later, but not in the way that we often think of it. But it's like an IOU. A government issues out these things called money in some kind of unit of account. Today we call that the dollar. And it serves as like an accounting instrument, an IOU. It spends it out, and in a certain part of the year, people have to pay back in taxes. And that's their IOU. They got to pay it back in taxes. And when somebody has this thing, this money thing, it's also an IOU in the form that that government is responsible for the value of that thing. If you have a $5 bill, the government owes you $5, and that's what you have, a $5 bill. So in this notion, in this paradigm, which is referred to as chartalism, which means that money is something, is this legal tool, this public utility that is invented by states, and it gets its value from the fact that we all have to pay our taxes at some point. And therefore we all need this, whatever unit of account this entity says that it is, if it's the dollar or whatever else, then we all need it because we all got to pay those taxes, right? And so in this notion of money, when you think about an entire economy, it's not that first you need a tax so that then you can spend. It's that where does the money come from to begin with? And the reality of it is that the government needs to spend it first because that's where it comes from. That's its origin. Or the government can give some kind of charter or allow some kind of license to a private bank to do it as well. But it always requires this kind of legal permission or source from a kind of state entity, a public entity, an authority in this sense. So a lot of the things that people consider is actually backwards. First, the government spends, and then it taxes. And the reason it taxes, there are several. One of them is, like I mentioned, to ensure that everybody needs to use that thing within those kind of political boundaries, like the United States. Everybody needs to use the dollars. Another reason is to take some of that money out to control for inflation. And then there are other reasons, right? Like you can tax to like shape incentives, maybe say that like we don't want people to do this as much, so we'll put a tax on it, things like that. But the notion that it needs to find those taxes in order to do anything is kind of backwards. The more that the government spends, all it's doing is putting money into the economy. And that money is the money that we need in order to live. And in order to employ people and feed ourselves and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And so when we think about the deficit, all that is the money that the government has introduced into the economy that it hasn't yet taxed back. And so where is that money? That's our money. We have that, right? Or, I mean, you know, and all, that depends on policy too, right? Because sometimes it's the 1% that has that. But oftentimes when it's through public purpose programs or socially minded spending or things that have to do with empowering working people, it's our money. So a lot of this narrative about shrinking the deficit and this and that has a lot to do with strangling everyday people in the economy by sucking out that much money and leaving money creation itself to the kind of credit that private banks create, which, you know, as we all know, has all kinds of awful interest rate or interest policies with it, and it contributes to bubbles and these crashes that we keep seeing, right? Because the whole way we approach this system is just really, really backwards and short-sighted. So
can I
that's
ask
kind
a
of,
question here, Andres?
Yes.
You know what it sounds like you're saying is that the purpose, the government is spending in order to support the things that will be needed and helpful to citizens, but when it restricts that capacity and in fact outsources it to private banks to issue that and to issue credit, we not only have the, the kind of up and down vicissitudes that you're describing, but we also, instead of, in the same way that, you know, now they want to privatize the post office or whatever, they're trying to privatize everything, but to start with, they privatized money, and that means that what the banks will choose to give credit to, is... it may not be a top-level democratic social priority that most people would agree they need and want, such as social supports and infrastructures of all the kinds that we're talking about, or even, you know, the need to meet a major global crisis, you know, that will put, you know, that's putting all our lives at risk and that of future generations. But instead, you know, what... funding is created is in the hands of a private entity, the banks, who may have completely different criteria for what they want to support. So basically the whole thing where we give all this money to private sources that have no responsibility or accountability to either reinvest it or to fund things and undertake things that are safe, healthy, sustainable, productive. You know, there's very little on them that they have to do to be accountable for or repay this tremendous gift to them. And so, therefore, the things that we need to have done, healthcare, infrastructure, roads, a Green New Deal, aren't getting done because we've already given away the task of giving economic benefit to a private entity rather than allowing
a
public entity to make that is guided by the public will to make that determination. Is that a kind of accurate?
Yes, I think that would be very accurate and fair to say. And moreover, what's happened is that households and businesses are incredibly in debt themselves because the incomes and the state of the economy cannot keep up with the amount of private debt that's being issued by these private entities. And a big reason for that is because we've pursued policies which are so grounded in this deficit and debt hysteria that no public money is being reintroduced into the economy to do the things we need to do to raise incomes and to build infrastructure and to raise quality of life and all of these social and environmental goods that we need. So we're not meeting these needs, as you mentioned, and we're also in private debt that we owe to these private institutions. And so that's a huge problem. And when we talk about balancing budgets and trying to reach a surplus, like something that the Clinton years were so proud of, we reached a surplus. We hear even Democrats and Obama and all these people talking about how Republicans are, they're actually the ones that are increasing the deficit. That is incredibly short-sighted and counterproductive because when you are getting closer to a surplus, what are you doing to, you know, private people, to working people? That means that they're more in debt because that money is being taken out. That money is being taxed out of existence or it's just not being spent. And so this notion of having to balance a budget is actually, you know, screwing all of us over. And this is because, you know, once again, the federal government is the monopoly issuer of this currency. They are the ones that issue it. And we as people, as households, as families, as working people, as business owners, whatnot, we are currency users. So the relationship is different. And that's a very important distinction to make. And even municipal governments and state governments are also currency users. But the federal government is the only entity in the United States that has this capacity to issue the U.S. dollar. So there's two other important points to make with that. Number one is some of your listeners might be thinking, well, what about the debt, right? We're going to owe all of this money to bondholders. We're going to owe all this money to China, some people think, right? And this was something that took me a while to kind of get my mind around, and when I finally did, it was kind of just like, you know, very enlightening. But really, the way that our institutions are set up is so that when we do this deficit spending, the Federal Reserve is trying to reach its overnight interest rate policy, which again, all of this is based on all of this kind of backwards economic orthodoxy and whatnot. But what it's doing is it's selling all of these treasury securities, which is another legal instrument similar to a U.S. dollar, to people that have money on hand, and it's kind of an exchange. And so really what people think the deficit is just a giant savings account that exists at the Federal Reserve. If we can imagine when we have dollars, we have some kind of checking account. It's the same thing at the Federal Reserve. When the Federal Reserve sells these treasury bonds, treasury securities, it transfers to like a savings account. And as we know, savings accounts get interest on the savings. So when China has all of these dollars that it gets from the things that they sell to us and they have, you know, they accumulate all these dollars, and what do they do with it? Well, they put their money in a savings account. They buy treasury securities and they get interest on that. So what that means is that there's nothing unsustainable about that. it's just swapping one legal instrument for another that the U.S. can never run out of. But it is giving them a little bit of interest, which serves like a subsidy. It's like, imagine like a basic income, except to mostly wealthy people. And so what that means is like, that's a problem that we can change through policy, but it's not some unsustainable thing that's going to explode the economy and bankrupt all of us. Like that's the wrong concept to understand this by. Does that make sense?
Yes. So what you're saying is that we're calling it a debt when, in fact, they're holding a kind of investment and they're getting a return. And so the concept is that they could turn around and call us on that debt and say, okay, I want to sell this treasury back to you.
Right.
You know, so the idea is there could be a run on the bank, and China could, you know, destabilize us if they suddenly were like, well, I don't want to hold these right now to punish you because you have this terrible precedent or something. You know, in other words, if we stayed on the good side of people, this wouldn't even be a kind of necessarily a concern, because other wealthy, other nations with huge assets also have to park they're holding somewhere. They have to put them somewhere. They, you know, and so it's kind of serving both parties. Yeah. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. That's the way I would kind of look at what you're saying.
Well,
does that make sense?
That's a common reaction to it. But in reality, bondholders and countries that are seeking these treasury bonds, they're the ones who want to keep it because they're getting a subsidy off of it. Right. And if they didn't, then so be it. There's nothing stopping the United States government from paying all of its obligations. Because, as we mentioned before, the United States government has a monopoly over the U.S. dollar, and there's no limit on these financial terms to paying back whatever interest or whatever thing was on those treasury securities. So the real limit to spending, because some people are going to say like, oh, well, that's inflation and you're going to get hyperinflation and whatnot, right? Or that we're advocating, or that this paradigm, commonly known as the modern monetary theory, is advocating for infinite spending or infinite printing of money, right? None of which is true, even printing itself is not even what happens. People are very misled about all of this. The real limits to what a fiat monopoly issuer of a currency like the U.S. government can do and can spend is real resource availability. That is what can lead to inflation or can lead to problems. If we overspend, it means that we're putting money into something where the resource capacity and the labor has reached its limits. That we don't have the capacity to do anything with that money anymore, and so that starts to drive prices up.
In other words, if we're investing in renewable energy, or solar. Let's just make it real simple: solar panels on rooftops or whatever. And now that's all been enacted. Then if we issued more investment, more money to do that, then. And it's not needed anymore, then that would create a problem. Would that be like...
Well, it's not if it's not needed anymore. It's if we just don't have the people to do it. Mm-hmm. We ran out of labor. We reached full employment. Or maybe there is some kind of technology that we just don't have. And so we keep investing in some kind of goal, but nobody knows how to do it. And so, nothing's getting produced. So that might cause a problem as well. And there are ways to deal with this, which many of my colleagues have written about. People assume that what we say is to, as soon as we reach these limits, then that's when you raise taxes. And that is one way to do that, to drain money from the economy, but that is not necessarily the best way to do it. A lot of sources of inflation come from exactly what you were talking about earlier, all of these private institutions that are irresponsibly spending on things that are not very productive. And so we can put some credit controls on private banks and use tougher regulatory policy in order to control some of that inflation. Because when we think about healthcare prices right now, when we think about education prices and food and housing, those things are all inflated. And they're inflated because of private institutions, not the federal government. And so if we were to control those more or use more policy on that end and bring those prices down, we may be able to, or maybe like in the case of private healthcare, very much shrink that industry. What that would do is it would free up resources. It would free up people. It would free up time. It would free up, you know, resources. And we could use those resources for things that we need, like a Green New Deal. So that's really kind of the basic concept.
So the inflated drug prices that we're looking at now, which are just so out of the box, have to do, you know, with both these CEO incomes. They have to do with the large infrastructure. And they have to do with inflation. They are actually the inflation that we're afraid of is happening, you know, not in the dollar, but in the things that people need: food, health, shelter, transportation, education. Those things are too expensive in this particular dynamic. And actually, housing too, because, you know, they've kind of set the bar where people can't even be housed. Can't afford housing under these circumstances, and that would be increasing. So it's not just that we're giving a tax giveaway to the people who are profiting from this, but we're actually the taxes would be a way that I know that it's not how the people in modern monetary theory recommend funding things, but the taxing would actually be a give back or some small return of these enormous profits back into the public coffer. So it's not only are we publicly not even doing that, but it's just that we've already given them the barn, which is the capacity to control all of this. You know,
I think there's a bit of a difference in how we should be thinking about this, because the taxes that we place on wealthy people may be very, very good and desirable to control power inequalities. And I think that that's very, very important to do that, because people have too much power, and we could set some kind of ceiling or say like, no, this is just too much. This is bad for democracy. This is completely creating an unjust society at this point. But none of that money is going to pay for anything, because again, if we understand that what is actually limiting or creating space to fund things are resources and not money, then we see that taking money from taxes is not going back to any coffer. It's just getting deleted. Mm-hmm. So the actual evaluative measures, the way we should be evaluating whether we can spend or not spend, or how policies can create space for more spending, has nothing to do with like strict financial things. Again, this is why if bondholders want their interest back or whatever, I mean, it's fine. Or if they don't want to park their money, it doesn't matter, because that's not what is limiting the federal government. It's this issue of resources and what we can produce and what we should be producing and what we need and what we have available. And so this is where you get into this idea of employment versus unemployment and how we are employing the people of our society and of our country. So we have come to this point where, again, the orthodoxy in the mainstream believes that you need a certain percentage of unemployed people to always exist, because that's the only way to keep inflation from getting too out of control. And what we are advocating from the modern monetary perspective is that another way that you can kind of control for inflation and also meet a very important social goal is to create a jobs guarantee program. Mm-hmm. And so the jobs guarantee program serves as this base living wage and guaranteed right to work through a locally administered system that offers jobs for these three categories, right? Are they meeting community needs, social needs, or environmental needs? And we put a living wage on this, and anybody who wants this job can get a job doing so, right? So this is a way that we employ people. We employ everybody that wants to work. And if the private sector needs more people to do other jobs, you know, they can hire people from this unemployed program or this employed jobs guarantee program as well. But it also puts pressure on them to create better working conditions, to raise their wages and whatnot. And so this is kind of a way to empower working people, because one of the most disempowering things is the threat of unemployment.
Definitely. Wow. So, and then we're kind of coming down to our last 8 minutes on the show. So I just, in the category that you just mentioned, is environmental services. So there you basically mm-hmm. are creating the platform for, hiring the people and investing in the initiatives on these varied fronts that are part of the Green New Deal package. And actually, I'm sure, given what you're saying, that's kind of a baseline right there. And, you know, with community services, then we also, you know, we could see healthcare in there or a whole range of other things. And it's not just, I mean, employing the people is like an important investment for both the people and for these projects that you want to do. And I'm sure that also there are other vehicles for public investment in the kinds of things that we've been talking about that are protective of people, of society, and of, democracy and of the environment in this different economic paradigm. And, you know, that we're discussing, it's like suddenly instead of being out there like little orphans, you know, begging for a few drops from these all-powerful figures and currying, their favor or whatever, as they ignore us, which is our current dynamic, and that's actually an authoritarian dynamic, as you pointed out earlier. You know, instead, it kind of, we have taken the wheel, and the brakes and the accelerator, and are driving the car. You know, it puts
in terms of
the economy.
I think that's really the key. I think you said it very, very well right there. That is the key, that we realize, we kind of have this epiphany that we don't need to rely or depend on taking a little bit here and a little bit there, or finding a way to find, you know, whatever it is that we can, so that we can have these things that we. Right now, climate change is a threat to civilization, and yet we can't act because we think we don't know where to find the money to pay for it. And that's kind of absurd, because, yep. You know, money itself is just a social legal invention. So I think it's really, really important that we shift the way we understand what our federal government and our country can do, and every other country around the world, because then you have to think about how many countries around the world have this same freedom that the United States has. And the ones that do, like Australia, like Canada, and many other countries, the ones that do should be pursuing this exact same Green New Deal. The ones that don't, like countries in the European Union, who don't have the capacity to issue their own currency because they're all under the EU, should be talking about either pressuring some entity in the European Union to be able to use fiscal policy and be able to actually spend on the things that are needed for the entire political body that is the European Union. Or should be talking about giving back, fiscal sovereignty and monetary sovereignty to the individual nation. And then you have countries in the developing world who the reason that they cannot do what the United States can do is basically because they have debts that are denominated in US dollars or in the currency of other countries. And so mm-hmm. that is the problem there. We don't owe anybody anything in another currency. It's all in US dollars. But a country like Mexico, countries in Latin America, countries in Africa, in the global south, because of these policies by the IMF, by the World Bank, loans and their reliance on investments in American dollars or whatnot, all of their debts are in somebody else's currency. So that disempowers them, right? So this whole paradigm of modern monetary theory forces us to think about these things, forces us to think about real resources, what's available, what space we have to be able to spend. Are we employing everybody to their full capacity? Are we employing our intellectual, creative, and labor skills to their full capacity? Or are we kind of being brainwashed by these outdated, completely detached from reality theories from economic orthodoxy?
Well, that's a beautiful way to conclude the program. I mean, I think, you know, it's hard to change paradigms. It's hard to change deeply ingrained attitudes. And the first way to do it is to really name them. And then we begin that project. We'll have to have you and your other colleagues come back onto the show to continue that educational process. But thank you so much, Andres Bernal, for beginning this here in Connect the Dots today. What is a good website resource that you would point our listeners to read more and learn more? And of course, we'll be hopefully continuing this discussion. I'll be posting stuff about it on Facebook, and you know, as you do, Andres Bernal on Facebook. But where else would you suggest people turn?
I would suggest people go to the Global Institute for Sustainable Prosperity. Mm-hmm. I think you mentioned that, and that website is global-isp.org.
Mm-hmm.
And
terrific.
Then there is the Modern Money Network, and that website is modernmoneynetwork.org.
Mm-hmm.
And I would also, let's see, there's one more, but it's leaving my mind right now.
That's okay. I'll post about it with the show on Facebook. So, you know, we have many crossover listeners. So, yeah. You know, thank you so much. I hope you'll come back again and continue our educational process here. You know, thank you, Andres Bernal, and for being with us today and Connect the Dots. And for this great work, it's really very hopeful, and we should take that hope and move it forward to elect the candidates that will act upon this. Rather than the people who are telling Wall Street as they take their money that nothing has to change. Thank you, listeners.
Absolutely.
For being with us.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
thank
really.
You so much for having me.
It's been a joy. Thank you, listeners, for being with us on Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Be well. Keep marching forward with all our relations.
And it was night.